I really believe if you were to go and talk to our missionaries, when I first came with a mission, they hated the agency. I was shocked. I went out there and I had these field council meetings and, oh, you're heavy, you're top-handed, you know, you're way too big. And I felt like, whoa, what did I walk into? Now I go out there and they just love us because they know we're not running their life. We know we're not manipulating, but we'll do anything to help them succeed.
So you've got a young man who wants to plant a church. He could, I mean, he could go to, you know, some town in Nebraska, get a job in a supermarket, just start planting the church. How is he further ahead to work with an agency rather than just go doing it with his local church, you know, ascending church behind him?
If his Sunday church was very strong and really committed, it probably could be done without any problem. Mm-hmm. But most pastors are so busy. Go talk to Pastor Morell or wherever you go and say, do you have time to come and spend time with me, help me, encourage me? He's going to say it's limited. So,
yeah, by the way, Pastor Morell is one of the few who will actually do that.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I mean, he goes and sees the church's missionaries. Well, he gets right in the middle of it.
He should, and every pastor should. But it's hard for a lot of pastors to do that. I think you get, there's a family of missionaries that are all doing the same thing. They feed off each other. I also think that if you're with an agency, then we have the connections to help you with the building program. Another thing we started as a subsidiary corporation called Church Care, where this sounds strange, but we're helping churches that vote to close to go in and counsel them to redirect their funds into church planting so that we're preserving funds so you can borrow to build that building. And so, like, we were at 30,000 when I started a subsidiary corporation. Now we're at about 400,000. And my goal is before I retire that we might have 2 or 3 million. As an illustration, a church in Portage, Michigan was worth 900,000. And the last 12 people decided that it would be better for the E-Free to have it for 125,000 than to just put it on the market and wonder who would get it. So the E-Free, they left $750,000 of Baptist money on the table. We could have built 2 small buildings with that money. And so I just said, this can't happen. So now we have helped, and we're starting to get calls. We helped a church last week that's decided to close. We don't close any of them. They have to decide that on their own. But we're counseling them and preserving a lot of assets. Okay. That would help a missionary huge.
So there is support from the office. There is support from being in a network. There can be ways of financial help for a church that is trying to get off the ground. There are real tangible benefits.
And most
there.
Churches will not support a guy if he's not with an agency.
That's true.
They just don't dare. We had a missionary right now that just resigned because he was getting about $80,000 a year support and he was wanting to work full time. So we kind of said, no, that doesn't work. So
I wouldn't mind doing that.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. I said, you as a missionary get more than I get, way more than I get. And I said, so he said, well, I'm going on my own in my own church. I mean, he's going to lose it. He doesn't realize it, but he's losing it. So,
let's talk about the process of actually planting a church. I suppose the first thing that has to be decided is where you're going to try to plant one, right?
Mm-hmm.
What goes into that decision? How does that decision get made?
It's funny, almost everyone that comes to us already has a place picked out that God has burdened their heart for. But when new missionaries leave and they go to another one, there's usually 3 or 4 places that are begging for someone. So it just seems to happen. The one thing that, you know, you can go do demographics, yeah, but like Dubuque, I'm more interested in Dubuque, not because it has 95% Catholic and really needs a church, but because there's a mother church, another church, really praying and interested for that area. It was 3 of the churches, Williamsburg, Iowa, Kansas City, where Aaron Lavender is, and Gretna. We found out after they were started that people had been praying 30 to 40 years for a church there. So what I'm asking God, show us where you got people praying. That's what we're looking for. But there are places that... basically, that's how it happens. It just all of a sudden God puts up. Sometimes we pick some places and God doesn't seem like we ever get anybody there. If we pray, now like Tracy, California, we prayed for 7 years weekly in our office because we were told there was a need for a church there, and there was. We prayed for 7 years. We have found it almost takes 7 years every single time before that prayer is answered. So this is longevity. But somebody probably is praying around this area, has been praying. It'd be really interesting if on the radio, I was listening to it this morning, it would be really interesting for someone to say, ask a question on the radio, Christian radio. Is there anybody out there that's been praying for a specific spot for church planting for the last 5 or 7 years, 10 years, 40 years? That's where I'd want to be.
You know, there are communities with no churches.
Right.
But there are very few of those. You know, I mean, so how do you determine a community? You know, here's Atlanta. There's tons of lost people in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
There's churches in Sioux Falls. How do you bridge between a community that seems to have tons of churches but still needs to be evangelized versus a community that has some pathetic churches? You know, how do you make those distinctions?
In a church community that has a whole lot of churches, I'd want to know that there is a group of believers that are dissatisfied and cannot get expositional preaching and want to plant a church. That would be my hope. Illustration down in Crossville, Fairfield Glade, Tennessee. 13,000 retired people. There was only a Southern Baptist church. And the people all that moved down there from the north tried it. But man, the preaching, there was just nothing there. So they organized and planted a church. And we have a missionary there. I thought that was a legitimate need. My druthers are to be in communities like Bennington, which has only one church, and Bennington, Nebraska, has one Lutheran church. That's where, and huge population taking place, that's where we like to be. But I'm not opposed to going to a large place if there is a group that want to help start that church. Then I say, well, God must be doing something there because he's moving people.
How much of a group would be your... Do you have a rule of thumb for the kind of group you'd want to see in a place like that? I think years ago, Dr. Zempel, didn't Chief Jordan say like 10 families before he'd send in a church planner?
If they're tithing, then 10 families can support a pastor.
Do you have a rule of thumb? Does Baptist Church Planters?
I wouldn't say we do. There were 12 couples in Fairfield. We don't get very many calls from groups that call us and say, we're here, can you send us somebody? I hardly have any of those.
So when you start praying for a community, it's usually a community where you know there isn't a gospel witness at all.
Right. Well, you just have to travel in the United States a little bit and your heart gets really burdened. The ethnic diversity in our country is incredible. David Witcher, I don't know this for sure, but David Witcher was in Los Angeles. They speak 89 languages in Los Angeles. You know, David said you can go into certain places in Los Angeles and it's the whole McDonald's is all Filipino or Asian. You go in another restaurant, it's all Hispanic. One of the things that Dr. John Williams, he was with me for a while. He's now just trying to finish up a church. He's black. He wanted every church to be multicultural, multi-ethnic. Heaven will be that way, but it's awful hard to get it here on earth. And this is my conclusion after all these years watching this. Birds of a feather flock together. Hispanic people really want to be with Hispanic people because they're comfortable with that. It's just like Anglos want to be with Anglos because they're comfortable. Where our comfort level is. The only place, so I don't have a problem planting an Hispanic church or an Asian church.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's welcome. And they're trying to reach everybody, or in a black community. So I call it communities. We're in this community, that community, so forth. The only place I see where churches are diverse, very diverse, is where the population is very diverse. Like if you go into New York City, we haven't planted a church in New York City. But those churches in New York City that are planted and established, they might have 22 nationalities in them. That's just the way it is. They live among it. That's where they work. They don't know any different.
It reflects the community itself.
Exactly. So if you're in a primarily a black community, the church is probably going to be led by a black. And by the way, the blacks, they plant a church, they stay there. We don't have any church planters that plant a church and move on in the black community. It's different. And that's the tradition in the black community. If you want a church, go plant one, and it's your church till you die. You know, if you go in the National Baptist, you'll see that. I mean, he might not even be able to get to church, but he's the pastor when he's dying. So
okay, we've got a place selected now. Mm-hmm. What are the next steps that a missionary or a missionary team goes through to get a church put there?
There's two different views on that. Three. One would be you immediately put up your shingle someplace in a school or wherever you can rent a place, and you start passing out stuff and start services. That's the old way of doing it. J. O. Purcell planted one in Illinois. Just go out, open up the door, and ask people to come in. There's another way, and I'm not big on it, but Southern Baptists push it, is preview services. They have a service once a month, and they really push hard. They get a lot of people to come in, and they do that for 6 months, and then they take the group that they've connected with, the people that are out there, the interested, and they start developing Bible studies, and then in 6 months they start the church. Roger let Blaine do that. They tried that in Chelco. It didn't work. They lost momentum in between the services. So I'm not crazy about that approach. I think when you do start services, you need to keep going. The other view is, and I espouse this to a degree, he would go in, a missionary would go in, and he would take and go and knock on doors and try to find anybody he can that would be willing to have a Bible study. And then try to get somebody else to come in and start Bible studies. Let's say maybe the first 6 months are just Bible studies all over the place. And then you say, you know, I got another Bible study over here. Hey, would you be willing to let them come over for tonight and get them to know each other? And the next thing you know, hey, we ought to start a church, you know, and get it going. Now, when you do start that church, though, you already want to have the name chosen, the constitution and bylaws and statement of faith done. That's not up for grabs. It used to be the old way. They'd get a group of people together. Well, what do we want to name this church? That's why a lot of churches have weird names. Everybody put their name in a hat, and you don't want to do that. And then they would say, well, let's write a constitution. Well, everybody that ever been in a problem wrote their problem into the constitution.
Yeah.
You read these constitutions, and you can see what the problems of the past members have been for the church. And then the missionary's in a hornet's nest, and he can lose everything he ever started with.
Yeah.
So we have a model constitution and a model doctrinal statement. In the constitution, we even went through the Christian Law Association to make sure some of the things that have to be in it are in it, because that's important today. But then you take and branch out from that as you go and develop it. The first stage often is they call it a fellowship stage. You can't. You're not a church. You're not organized. So you call it a fellowship stage. And often, well, what do you do with people that want to get baptized and become members? Well, you usually use the sending church or the mother church to be. I don't know. How did you do that in Dallas?
We didn't have a mother church. And
yeah.
So we were not able to observe ordinances until we actually adopted constituting acts and became a church.
All right. So you just had services.
For about 6 months.
And then you had a charter membership.
Right.
And after that, you organized. And
We adopted our constituting acts at 11:59 on New Year's Eve of 1992, and the first event of New Year's Day was a Lord's Table service.
Amen. Well, that put some significance to it.
It did?
Yeah. Sometimes they'll use a mother church or whatever, or a sister church that they can become members of. But the best thing to do is organize as fast as you can, because if you don't leave it up to them and you already have the documents, I mean, you're ready to roll once you have people that you've trained in membership. And even if you only have a membership of, and you can appoint three people You can appoint three people, like in New York you have to have three trustees. Well, you can appoint three people to be trustees, but just tell them you're simply trustees to satisfy the state. You're not deacons. So the last thing you want to do is appoint a guy a deacon just so you can satisfy a trustee deal and then be in trouble with them.
Okay, so we're up, you know, we've got a congregation organized. We're through the fellowship stage. We've got a church formally here. Is the missionary's work now done? He moves on and does something else?
No, because he, until he has leadership, deacons, and that are trained, I don't think his work is done. And unfortunately, if you think of planning a church of getting a crowd, you're going to be in trouble and you're creating something that's going to be very weak. If you are planning a church with the idea you're discipling and making disciples of Christ, and I had a problem with that. When I was 21, I started ministry. When I was 32, I had accomplished everything I thought I wanted to accomplish, and I went in kind of a slump. And but when the Lord talked to me about, you've done a good job getting the crowd, now why don't you make a few disciples? That was startling to me. I wish they would have told me that in school, because anybody can get a crowd. I mean, just go out and look at some of the crowds. It depends on what you want to do to get a crowd. You can get a crowd, but it takes a lot of work to make a disciple. So your job's not done until you've made disciples who can be qualified leaders of the church, because then it can be an organized church.
I've got one more question for you, and that's this. We've got guys here whose calling is really to pastor. Would there be any benefit to them as a pastor in the long term to go through the experience of being on a church planting team as part of preparation for the pastorate? And how do you think that would change their perceptions as a pastor? How would it change their ministry? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it does. It would be dramatic. It would give you a passion for missions that you would never have any other way. Guys have said, and personally, I haven't been overseas. I always sent members of our church to visit our missionaries. I made a mistake. I should have went. But I always wanted our people to, because this is the way I felt. I'm going to leave this church, but they're here to stay. I want them to identify with the missionaries. So in one way it was right, but the other way it was wrong. But because my father, I didn't plant any churches, but my father, I pastored the whole time, but my father was a church planter, and I have two brothers that are church planters. So church planting was in the DNA of our family. We just talked about it all the time. But as a pastor, because I had that influence, and because I was on a church planting board the last half of my pastoral ministry, I mean, I did everything I could possibly do to enhance that church planter, because I knew what they were going through. I knew the struggles they were having. And when we planted out of the church I was pastoring, that church in Hamilton and Cornerstone, we were there, you know, we were there all the time, helping them, assisting them, helping build. And my brother was calling me, what do I do now? I think it would really open your heart and make you appreciate what it is to have a small group when no pianist shows up, Sunday school teachers are not committed, and then when you go to church, say, wow. Make you appreciate your church a lot more. And also appreciate what the missionary is going through. It's interesting. We encourage all our church planters to invite their supporting pastors to come in and preach for them on a Sunday. I tell them that's only good psychology. First, he gets a chance to be away from his own pulpit. He can use a message probably that he's used in the past. Thirdly, he feels, you know, sometimes you have to use a little psychology. He feels pretty important because this missionary is inviting him to speak at his church. And he's got a chance to go out and get an opportunity, chance to meet. But when he comes there, the missionaries all say this, he leaves changed. He is now seeing with his own eyes the people. You know, even as a president, sometimes I'll see a work and I say, this is not a real church plant. It's a preaching station. We're going to have to end our relationship with it. It's really hard when you go there and look those people in the eye and say, we're going to break our relationship with it, because it just isn't going to be able to, accomplish what we say we do. It changes a pastor when he's there. And I think if you had a chance to go out and work with a church planter, even if it was just a two-year stint and say, I'll work, I'm just coming here to help you and do anything I can, it would enhance your life, either here or overseas.
Would most church planting missionaries welcome a seminary graduate who would do that?
Yeah, right. Would they invite, have anybody, would be happy if anybody showed up? Yeah. Oh, they'd be thrilled. It depends. Now, if you go in there and try to tell him how to do everything, he's probably not going to be too happy about it. But if you go in there to serve, he'd be thrilled. My father would say, and all our missionaries talk about it, one thing about a church plant is everything you do is brand new. And so there's a constant thrill, there's constant excitement. God provided this, God provided that. Hey, here's a new person. One of the hard parts I found, because I followed my father and I followed another man that was a church planter, is that when you can't do a whole lot of new things, like we didn't get new chairs and we didn't get new tables and we didn't get a new communion set and we didn't get anything new, now we're going to have to slug it out here as a mature church. Control, touchy little area. Actually, the pastor that follows the church planter has got to be the right guy, because he can either destroy everything that was built, or he can make it go on. And that we've seen both. So yeah, it's exciting to plant a church. There's hard times, but they're exciting. Most of the church planters, and even as I as a pastor once. The loneliness they saw as being alone as a church planter, not so much leaving the congregation and going on to plant another one. Because most church planters are not, they want to get another one up. And in my experience as a pastor, yeah, I wept like a baby when I left every church. Just wept. But when I pulled out the driveway, it was over. And I was on my next project. Now let me just say, for the women who are in here, it'll take you about a year to pull out of the driveway and get on with the next one, because your emotional attachment is not as fast, right? The wives, they struggle with that a lot more than the men. Because the men, we go to the next job, hey, there's what I got to do, dive right into it. And the wife will go and say, okay, what do I do now? But anyhow, back, the loneliness is just being alone, and that's where I want to create the teams where they're not alone. You have somebody to, you have partners. My dream is someday that there would be a team that would stay together their whole life and just go and plant one after another. That may happen, it may never happen. Culturally, I do believe that missionaries need to fit the culture. In other words, I'm not saying if a guy says, I'm absolutely called there, I know for sure. But now, if someone said to me, I feel God's calling me to reach Spanish people in the United States or Asians in the United States, and I have to go learn another language to do it, I have no problem with that. And they're going to go into that culture. But it'll be just as difficult as going overseas, in a sense, because of the culture. I have a friend that went down to North Carolina, and as soon as he got there, he called and said, man, he wouldn't believe it. Everybody talks about the Bible. They carry their Bible to work. And then they tell off-color jokes, and they're biased about 100 things, and you know, and then all of a sudden he finds out this is a cultural thing that is really hard to deal with. So if you were to take, I was talking to a guy called from Cypress Point, Texas the other day and said he's a pastor, and he goes, I don't know if I can handle this much longer. It's just the whole mental culture there that is, it's just, that's where I think you have to understand the culture and fit the culture unless God's really called you. What do you think the attitude in the United States of most pastors are toward church planting? What they forget is the church they're pastoring, somebody planted. You know, they forget that somebody, if there isn't somebody planting these churches, then there won't be. Another one I get is, well, why are you planting more churches? Our churches, the churches already in this city are struggling. That's why we're planting more churches, because yours is going to close in 10 years. You know, it's harder to rescue a church than it is to plant a new church. We listen to every church, and by the way, I've never had, ever, a man call. It's always a woman. Always a woman that calls and said, we're down to 10 people, and they are passionate. We cannot let this church close. We need help. So I send them to my brother, Peter, David, whoever, whatever part of the country is. They listen to their plea. And then if they feel, after listening to that, they need to make a personal visit, then they go and make a personal visit. They sit down with them. They look at it. But there's pages of questions we ask. And we will not take it unless we can change the whole Constitution bylaws. In some cases, we make all the officers resign. We tell them that we might change the name of the church. There's so many hoops they got to jump through before we'll take it. If at that they go through all those hoops, then if we have a person available, and usually we have a semi-retired pastor or missionary available, we send them in there for 6 months. They don't have to pay them unless they need a little support. They have to provide them their housing. And if they can't provide them their housing, then there's nothing we can do. They have to go in there and provide. In 6 months, we'll go in and analyze whether it is savable. That's how we do it. And everyone we've taken, we saved, is now called a pastor. But they know who controls the thing then. It's not them anymore. And if they, it's funny because my brother John, he's a master at it. John can walk in about 15 minutes, he's got it all figured out pretty much. He's just, it can read people. And he'll push the buttons that need to be pushed. And he'll find out what's really happening. Why is this, like one of the questions, when was the highest attendance in the church? When did it turn down? What would happen at that point? Is the person that has created problems still here? Usually they're in the room. And and it's interesting to watch their eyes, you know, but you figure it all out. So I have about 3 pages of questions that anybody taking and candidating a church should ask. Of all the things I've ever done in 12 years, those 3 pages are asked for constantly. I have to send them. I lost them. Can you send them to me? Because I'm going to be candidating and I want to ask the right questions. Because sometimes guys think when I go to a church, they're going to ask me questions. The reality is you should be asking the questions. Because you better turn over every rock before you go there. One of the guys that was in candidate school, he was in an IFCA church in Iowa, and it went good until he said, we've got to follow the Constitution. And the lead family of the church said, no, we do what we want to do. And so he resigned. So, hey, I have really enjoyed this interaction.